Like the mic.
Ricket.
So let's have you start off with the each of you saying your names and starting with I'm, and just introduce yourself.
Okay. Whenever you're ready. My name is Domingo Los Baños, and I've been a docent here since the beginning of the camp and beyond that. And I come on Wednesdays. I spend all day Wednesdays, and to me, it's like reliving my days of my youth every time I come here. But the camp is really a story of my life.
Introduce yourself. Can you say which camp you grew up on?
I grew up on Kauai in a pineapple plantation, but it's the same. The camp system for pineapple and sugarcane are the same. And so we have the same stories, but we concentrate on different products. I grew up here on Oahu, on Kauai, or rather on Oahu at Waihewa. Next to Schofield Barracks, and then moved to Kauai, but I grew up on Kauai and graduated high school there, and then came to university and soldiered.
What's your nationality?
I am Filipino. You can tell by my nose. I'm Filipino, and my mom came from the northern part of the Philippines, and so she's very good in Ilocano, Tagalog, Bisayan, the three major groups. My father came from Legazpi. My father came to San Francisco as a Navy man. They fathered seven children, five boys, and all the five boys have all been in either World War One, World War Two, or World War Two, Vietnam War, and the Korean War. So we're a bunch of soldiers.
We get that too.
Okay.
Okay. So, again, can you introduce yourself with your name, your plantation you grew up on, and your ethnicity?
My name is Amy Sakuma, and I'm Japanese. I grew up right here in Waipahu, and my dad worked in the pump department office, and he used his abacus for all his work daily, and never learned to do it. He tried to teach me, but I never did learn how to do it. And my parents came late to Hawaii, I think, in 1923, before the agreement where, no Japanese should enter. So my dad had quit college and gone to Seattle because he had friends there. And he tells us about working in the salmon industry during the summer. And then he had to play the foot organ for the Sunday school because no one to play that, you know. He was a frustrated musician because people of that era, the men don't go into music and the arts. You know, they expect to go into medicine and law and those courses, you know. And so, he came to Hawaii because my aunt was here in Hawaii at the consulate. And my mother had come with them. And I have a cousin who went to kindergarten here at Hananaoli School, he tells me. And so she came with them to, help take care and to help around the household. And then they were going to be transferred back to Japan, so they didn't want to leave a bachelor brother here. And so they're first cousins, and they were married here at St. Andrew's Cathedral. And it's kind of unusual because even my high school teachers told me, because we're Christian, very few Christians among the Japanese. But my mother was baptized as a child in Tokyo, you know. And so my dad is of Buddhist background, but he had to become a Christian to be married at St. Andrew's Cathedral. And so that's why we, ended up. And there was only one church, which was a Methodist church in Waipahu, Japanese language church. So that's where we grew up. And now it is a UCC church, but, it has a long history.
And just pretend like we haven't met before and just introduce yourself.
I'm Esperanza Gabriel Garcia, very Spanish, but I am Filipino. And I was born and raised on the island of Kauai. We lived in a small plantation camp of 11 houses. We were multi-ethnic when we were placed in that camp, but when we transferred over to Oahu, my dad was transferred over into a Spanish camp. I did not understand why it was that, but I realized our last name, Gabriel, was Spanish, so we were placed in a Spanish camp. normally we are placed in Filipino camp or Japanese camp, depending on your ethnicity. But we were in a Spanish camp. And this is where, in the town of Waipao, where I finished my schooling, graduated, and still live here, a walking distance from the Hawaii Plantation Village. And I joined this particular group to be a docent, never knowing what that word meant until I realized in the dictionary it said interpretive guide. And the only thing I can do about being a guide was talk about my life as a plantation laborer's daughter. And I come here 3 Mondays a month, not the second Monday because I golf, and everybody knows that. I do a lot of cooking. Cooking is my ministry, and my husband supports me 100% financially so that I can cook and give away that food. And so I'm involved with church, golfing, and here, cooking all the time. I give food away constantly because I love to cook. And my mama was an excellent Filipino cook. She always believed in inviting people when she did a lot of cooking, or just cook. If she saw a stranger passing by, she'd invite them. And I used to ask mama, why you do that, mama? She says, oh, and she quoted the Bible, and I didn't know what it meant at that time. She said, you invite somebody that might be an angel, and you're not aware of them. And when I saw that, when I became a Christian, in Hebrews 13:2, that's exactly what she had said, but she said it in Filipino. And she loved the Lord so much that she always was a positive woman. She encouraged us to do the best things, and she always looked for the strong point of a child. And she said, mine was cooking, and mine was playing.
Can you tell us about your parents when they came over? You said a little bit.
Okay, my dad was hired in the Philippines in 1926. And so he was assigned to the island of Kauai, the town of Kekaha, the Kekaha plantation. He left my mama with 6 children, and she joined him in Kauai in 1928. But in that 2-year interim period, she lost 4 out of the 6 children and 2 infant children within a week's time from dysentery. That blew her mind, and she just wanted to die. She just walked straight to the river to drown herself. But neighbors pulled her out. And every time she tells us that story, goosebumps come on me. And I always used to tell Mama, Mama, I'm so happy neighbors pulled you out, because there were 4 of us that were born on Kauai, and I'm the youngest of 10. And so it's like the Bible story of Job, where he lost everything and then got replenished. And I told Mama, that's how it is. But she was a positive woman. She never cut us down. In fact, there's an incident about cooking that she really was an encourager, because when I tried to make my first batch of cookies, my papa was the official taster. He could not bite into that cookie. My brother was the second one to eat and try to eat it. He couldn't bite into it. He gave the dog the cookie, and the dog spat it out because he couldn't bite it. My brother picked it off from the floor, threw it against the wall. It bounced on the cement floor, and it did not crack. And I cried. I cried, Mama, the wise woman she was, she put her arms around me, and she said, daughter, that's okay. You can always make again. But she said, don't ever forget that recipe. You have the recipe for cement.
I'm Moses Pakaki. I was born on Maui, Paia, Maui. My parents did not work for the plantation. I did not live in a plantation camp, but we were surrounded by plantation camp, Portuguese camp, Puerto Rican camp, Japanese, Chinese, Filipino, Puerto Rican, and all of my friends were plantation. My friends were all plantation. They belong in the plantation. I went to school, and all of the school students were plantation students. So I was surrounded with plantation life. I knew about the Japanese school that they had. I knew about the shows that they used to bring from Japan to the plantation community. I used to attend all of those activities. And Maui was famous for the county fair. And all of those shows that came to the county fair did come to the plantation village also. So we had a lot of people that act their cultural. Chinese had their own acting shows, and Japanese, and the Puerto Ricans, like SB had mentioned, They loved the music, and we always had Puerto Rican music. And I used to go to their shows, and there was always fight, always having fight. But that was part of the Puerto Rican culture. They always needed to be right with everybody else. But yes, we had Hawaiian camp also, and all of my friends' family lived in this Hawaiian camp. The community was divided in, they had a lower Paia, which is the town part of Paia, and they also had upper Paia, which was the plantation community. And we had a sugar mill right close by. All of the sugar cane was surrounded around the whole community, including the area where I lived. I lived not exactly lower Paia, but about a mile away. And we lived close to the ocean. But sugar cane fields were all on the upper side. When they harvested, we could tell that they were ready to harvest the sugar cane field because they had flags set out, and the tractor would come and do a fire break. They would move the sugar cane toward the center of the field, and then they would start the fire. And if you ever tasted burnt sugar cane, you can't beat that, you know. All of us can attest to that. The taste is you cannot describe the taste.
In a good way or a bad way?
Huh?
Good or bad?
Oh, it's good. Yeah, it's tasty. So
is it like caramel or something?
It's really sweet. If you tasted the raw sugar cane first, and then you taste the cooked sugar cane, then you really can tell the difference. That's about I can.
You saw people actually harvesting too.
Yes.
What was that like? You all did.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, you want to describe it? What is like harvesting?
I tell you the symbol of in the cane field is a cane knife. Mm. It's a broad blade with a hook, so you can pick up the cane and cut. And the whole fields are burnt first, so that all the opala, the dried leaves, are burnt out. Then only the stalk, and so it's easy to cut. See, early on, it was cutting by hand. Then eventually, they came with tractors that had clippers. Mechanization came in. So the plantation went through from manual labor through industrialization. Mm-hmm. From oxen pulling the cane to the trains and to trucks. So all that evolution of the coming of mechanization, we saw that. This was part of the plantation life. Mm-hmm. Biting sugar, it lasted me the whole year, my whole lifetime. I lost my two front tooth. My two front teeth.
Because you ate.
Because I was chewing it, you know. You try to break it with your teeth when you pull the cane from the cane trees, or rather cane cars. You pull it, and you try to bite it, and you know to shed it. Well, that thing is hard, and so I lost my two front teeth, and forever in my whole life, I don't have two front teeth. I have a plate. You want to see my plate?
Hold on a second. SB has to cough.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Lost your teeth too?
No, I have all my teeth, but they were well worn because we used to take our teeth and pull the skin out. Especially when you're going home from school, you went to public school, you went to Japanese school at the other end of town. We had a long way to walk because we lived in the valley that goes all the way to Wahiawa. You know, the stream, Waikele stream, goes all the way to Wahiawa. And the pump department office was there, and there were about four pumps over there, you know, and so the office was there. And we had a long walk home, and, you know, you're thirsty and hungry, so that's what you did. Uh-huh. You'd break it on the tracks, you know, get it, and then get the part you want to chew. Uh-huh.
But for us in the pineapple field, go out in the field early in the morning, and we know just the right pineapple to pick. And you cut the top, and that's throw it away, but the very bottom is where the sweetest part is, see. So we knew all that, so we were very, very choosy in how we sliced the pineapple. Mm-hmm. So we ate off the land.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, sugar takes about 18 months to grow, and so you can tell which fields are going to be harvested soon because of the tassels that you see on the field. Yes. Then they will, you know, harvest that.
It's getting close, close, yeah.
So it sounds like, from your experience, that you were able to interact with the many different ethnicities that made up the plantation. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Is that true? Because my understanding is that the camps were kind of segregated, but yet your interaction was multi-ethnic.
Yeah. We went to school together, so we grew up together. And I was always going toward to my friend's house, which was in a plantation camps. And we spent most of our time in the camps. So you get to know the lifestyle. You get to know the Puerto Rican, the Portuguese, and even the Hawaiians. In the Hawaiian camp, we had family. You can say we're all family because sooner or later you're going to find out that this Hawaiian family from Oregon maybe might be related. That's the way we look at Hawaiian family.
You know, the great equalizer.
Okay, amongst, can you start again? The great equalizer.
The great equalizer was the public school. Mm-hmm. So we came, and if we achieved, they recognized us for whatever we were worth. Now, for example, I grew up in a community where predominantly Japanese and Portuguese. Mm-hmm. But I was a good athlete. So in the morning, we would always play games, Portuguese against the Japanese. So where do I go? They all want me, see? If I want to eat noodles, I go Japanese side. If I want to go ride horse, I go Portuguese side. They are the horses. If I want to get a pickup truck to go to the movie, I would go to Okinawan side because they had a Model T Ford where they would pick up the slop. So that's how we learned to adapt to our best advantage, see? Now, another thing that brought us together was sports. Waipahu had Filipino ball teams, Japanese ball teams, Puerto Rican ball teams. But when one plantation plays another plantation, Waipahu against Wailua plantation, they take the best. And there's the mix, you see. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that caused us to become multi-ethnic, just imagine when a Japanese girl is washing the clothes of a Filipino man, see, and they have to deliver the clothes. So you touch hands, you touch hearts, and pretty soon you forget ethnicity, and you get married, and you run away to Sacramento. It actually happened, yeah.
Okay. So did everybody get along, or was there any kind of ethnic tension at all between people?
No, when we were growing up, you know. And I lived in our camp, because we're so isolated from the town. We were only two Japanese families. Across us was a Hawaiian man with a Portuguese wife. Next door were Portuguese, several Portuguese family. And then the sort of the boss of our area was Caucasian, name of Strolin, and his wife was Hawaiian, you know. And they had a large family. And so it was a mix. And then beyond that, there was a Portuguese man that had a dairy at one time. And then there was a Japanese camp of the people who took care of the fields around us. So they had a big public bath. And when we were growing up, you know, we'd put sweet potatoes in the ashes and bake them and, you know, eat them and things like that. And then when we wanted to watch them milk the cows in the afternoon, there was this big pipeline that took the water to the fields up, you know. And we'd stand on the pipeline and watch the milk, and they'd shoot the milk at our faces.
Yeah. You know, talking about school, in those days, everybody was the same. There's no rich people, there's no poor people, and we're all in between. But when you go to school, most of us take lunch, home lunch. And I used to take what they call saloon pilot cracker and jelly to school. And when we got to school, we would look at maybe the Japanese, and they bring rice. And so what we did was exchange with them. We gave them the cracker and we took the rice. But sometimes they don't want to do that. And so when they're not looking, we'd grab their lunch and leave the cracker there. And so that was part of the fun of going to school with plantation kids. Yeah.
So I just have to say, when somebody else is talking, if you could not go, uh-huh, because it'll sound like they don't know who's talking, you know, because it's on the radio. But, you know, I wonder, too, when you were at school, did the teachers, how many people talked, you know, or spoke pidgin at
we
school?
All did. We all did. In fact, when the teachers started to hear us talk, they couldn't make heads or tails what we were saying because they came from the mainland, generally. And so we had developed a lifestyle that was so unique that whatever we said, she could not listen to what we were saying at all. Because as for instance, like I'm going to say, oh, you go stigo. You ain't go over there. You know, and when we say the word dakain, you know exactly what we're meaning when you say, oh, did you see dakain? The person knew exactly what we're talking about. The word dakain is universal. We mentioned that for everything. Like, for instance, I would tell you, oh, did you see the kind that I pointed out to you in the Filipino house or the Japanese house or even underneath the tree? That's how we talk. But we had to learn good English eventually because that was a detriment to us.
What is the kind? What does that mean?
It means that one.
That kind.
Okay.
That now, but watch how we write perfect English. When we write and when we speak, two different things. My first year at college, Springfield College, I began to tell them, I apologize to my professor that I spoke in some pidgin. He says, you know, you keep that, because every time you speak, they all listen to you. So we should not lose this pidgin. But when we write, perfect English.
So you have two languages.
That's right.
Yeah. I had a little different experience in elementary school, you know. They had English standard schools, okay, like Lincoln and Roosevelt, because it's an English standard school in Honolulu. Well, Waipao is so far away, they had one class for each grade. And then and Augustine's was only up to, no, Waipao Elementary was for 4th, 5th, and 6th, and Augustine's was only to 3rd, you know. But I don't know how, but some of us were selected to go fill that class because they didn't have enough children, I guess, you know, who to fill that English standard class. I went to Augustine's for 6 years, which is kind of different, and I don't think my dad was too happy about that because that's farther away from where we lived, you know. But that's what they transported us, you know, a little truck to take us to school.
So this phenomenon of English standard schools, mm-hmm. that was the beginning of some segregation, mm-hmm. but the union people put a stop to that. They said you should treat everybody all together. Therefore, it came a time into territorial legislation, they debunked the English standard schools, and everybody had to go to the schools nearest where they were. So we went to a history of that. Mm-hmm. But the main people that objected to that were the union boys, when the coming of the union. And the coming of the union is another thing that brought us together. The Chinese struck, the lunas, the bosses would pull them by their pigtail early on and run them with horses. The Portuguese women struck alone. The Japanese struck alone. But in 1946, where they harmonized all the ethnic group, and we struck, and for the first time, the laborers won. We won $4 a day, 8-hour work, equal work for equal pay. From then on, you pay rent for the houses. And so that killed the paternalism of the managers, where they had bands sponsored by the plantation, or Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts sponsored by the plantation. All that's gone. It became a strictly boss and labor situation. The 46th strike made us the highest paid agricultural workers in the world. And that was the beginning of the demise of the plantation system. In 47, 46, 47, when we had 47, 48, 49 plantations and maybe five pineapple, now there's only one plantation on Kauai, one plantation on Maui, and one plantation of sugar on Kauai. No more. Kauai's gone. The whole lanai is wiped out. The only pineapple, there's pineapple on Maui, and there's pineapple here on Oahu. That's the change that has swept through the islands, you see.
What do you all remember about the 46th strike and the way that communities supported the strike?
Well, I was away in college, 46. Mm-hmm. I was away. But I do know that it pulled all the communities together. And you see, to prepare for a strike, you have hunting teams, fishing teams, soup kitchen, people that go and be the ones, if they have problems, you see them. We were all mixed. And as you, again, touch hands, touch eyes, touch hearts, you forget ethnicity. And you fall in love, see? And as long as you have a boy and a girl together, it's going to explode, see? And this is part of the things that made Hawaii so unique and so united. And the fact that we are all in one couple of islands, the only thing different with our immigration population here is we're all slant-eyed, see, mostly, and flat-nosed, you see. Whereas some of the, but we're in one island, concentrated. That's why it becomes so dynamic. And where, what state in the union can boast? We had a Japanese governor, followed by a Polynesian governor, followed by a Filipino governor, and now we have a woman governor who is a Republican. And that broke the democratic chain, you know. But that's the uniqueness. When you go behind the lines and think, how did Hawaii, through its political machination, come up with a Japanese governor? How can it be? And a Filipino governor. There must have been terrific cross currents. See, and that, as you watch that, that's the keenness. And that's really the magic of I'm from Hawaii. People sit up and look. It's because, and that was all built by our old, by the Filipinos, the Japanese, old-timers that came early on and were the pioneers in making Hawaii profitable and a place to reckon with as it comes to how to live together.
Anybody else have memories of the strike?
Yeah. I was in college then, and so I offered to leave school and take a job to help, you know. But my dad said, no, continue school, so I did. And he was... one of his jobs during the strike was to kind of work in the store, like a store where they distributed food to families that needed. And I think the supermarkets and things must have contributed, you know, rice and things like canned goods and things like that. And they would distribute food to families that needed it, you know. But I think and then, of course, we're all encouraged to plant vegetables at home. So, you know, we had a big backyard, so we grew a lot of tomatoes and things like that. And, you know, survive that way.
Do you know why there was not a strong inter-ethnic strike prior to 1946? Did your dad ever talk about that?
No, I don't know. And the Japanese struck, Filipinos on Kauai struck first. And then in the 1920s, all the Japanese workers on Oahu went on strike, and that was not successful. And then the two Japanese papers supported the workers, so the editors were thrown into jail, you know. And so not until, as I said, 1946 when they went island to island, plantation to plantation, and organize all of them.
That was the unity that mm-hmm. brought them mm-hmm. together.
Mr. Firm, that was
The unity that strike mm-hmm. another item that really brought the people together. They knew that they had to pull together in order to fight the managers. Mm-hmm. And that has encouraged people coming together, working together. Mm-hmm. And that's a value that's universal, mm-hmm. see.
The thing is that the plantations had an organization, you know. They were the big five, and they had an organization that kind of, you know, they could pool their ideas and things together, whereas the workers on the plantation, each one community was by itself, and there was nothing to tie them together until the strike. That was another reason, I think.
Can you describe the conditions that your family lived under that would motivate them to want to strike?
I don't know. Mm-hmm. My dad was a salaried person, you know, and because he had a white-collar job. So it's hard to say, but, you know, I think you still, you know, you all of your the other people are suffering so that they would be supportive, I think, you know. Because he was not in management as such, so, you know.
Were the families getting by, though, financially?
Well, I think we did, you know, because and by growing a lot of the vegetables and things that we needed. And everybody had chickens in the backyard, you know, for eggs and meat, so. Yeah.
You really had to be farmers to live, too, right?
Yeah, mm-hmm. But you were given months of preparation time.
Did you have something?
Well, what we had to do was plant our vegetables. We had to interchange. Some people had vegetables. You could exchange with other things. People had chickens. Some people raised pigs. And we on Kauai at that time, before way before the strike, we were raising goats. But when we came here, we had vegetables to share. And I remember the strike because it was 79 days long. We had to stand in line to buy rice from the store. But mainly what, as a young person, I remember even the song that said, I owe my life to the company, so company store, it's exactly what it was, because being a plantation laborer, my dad, we had to charge a lot of our groceries, and it just kept building up, just like today with our plastic cards, that builds up and builds up. So when we came to Oahu, my oldest brother got a job at Pearl Harbor, and because of his pay, he finally paid off our bill, and my mama was so, so grateful that eventually that bill was wiped out completely, because there was it just didn't seem like my papa's pay was enough to pay off the bill, because every month you were charging and you had to survive. But eventually, when after that bill was paid, somehow my mama and dad, we planted vegetables here, we leased a 3/4 acre farm, and we used to sell our vegetables on Sundays and save that money. So when my mama and papa went back to the Philippines to retire, and he took his retirement money, he had bulk money to build 2 apartments in the Philippines. But before that, they could have never done it if that bill was never paid up.
Can you describe, so they worked in the fields during the day, and then on weekends they would do farming, or how did they integrate taking care of the farming and working on the plantation?
Well, my dad was the only worker, aside from my brother eventually. But my mama, being very frugal, she knew how to plant vegetables between the sugar fields, mm-hmm. and use the water from the stream or the little ditch that was coming. She would have a long pole, attach a 1-gallon can to it, nail it, and use that as a bucket to water our vegetables. And she was very innovative with that. And we raised pigs, we raised cows, goats, we even had, and sold it. And because she could do a lot of good cooking, people ordered food from her. And so that's how it was just awesome to watch her do that. She taught us that you can live off the land, you can still make a living from it. And that was so awesome to watch that, because as she planted plants, she said, it's going to feed us and it's going to feed others. And I totally believe in that. And that's why I have cooking as my ministry today, because you do feed people.
And then what roles did your dad and mom play in the 1946 strike? Because I heard that each person kind of had a responsibility.
Right. My dad was concerned because when they said they're going to strike for a reason, and he was happy that now we're going to be stronger. We're going to be united. But we had to tighten our belts and help each other. And because my mama was a good cook, she would help cook for other people. And that was so interesting, because some people were not as, I guess, innovative as she was. Because us Filipinos are known to eat mysteriously. Because you plant weeds in your yard, it seems, but it's food for us. And so that's how they did it. Both of them put together the resources, and that's how we got along during the strike.
Talking about food. If you were to go to the supermarket now, you will know who grew up in the plantation, because they will buy these things. 2 cans of corned beef, 2 cans of Spam, 2 cans of Vienna sausage, and pork and beans. That was staple mixed with the garden things we grew. This is how we stretch the food. That's how you know a guy comes from Hawaii, by what he buys. To this day, you can see, oh, that guy plantation, just by what he buys, you know.
Was it a really hard time during the strike for the families?
Not with my mama, because she has taught us that eventually when we get married, she says the first thing you have to remember is have enough food in the house to last you till the next paycheck. And that's why we never had to worry. We never starved. We always knew that we had a certain meal. Like you said, it was stretched out or pulled together, but like I said, my mom was a good cook, so whatever she put on that table, it was awesome.
Well, you know, and during the war, you know, we were encouraged to grow our vegetables and things because everything was shipped over from the West Coast, you know. So we even grew celery, which is, and things that normally you would not grow to make us, Hawaii, help make Hawaii self-sufficient as far as food went. Rice and flour had to be imported, but, you know, fresh things, and meats and things have had to be imported. Of course, they were rationed, you know, butter and meats were rationed during the war.
How hard were the strikes? There were a number of strikes, about 3 major strikes. But in some of the earlier strikes, the people had to walk from Waipahu 30 miles to Ala Park. They walk. During strike, you cannot live in a camp. You got to live in tents outdoors, see. And during that early strike in the Japanese, influenza hit. 1,000 kids died, see. When the Filipinos struck in the 1925s, there was a big battle, a riot. I think about 30 people died, see. But these were all separate. Not until 1946, when they combined and they stood toe-to-toe, that they beat the plantation system. But again, that was the demise of the plantation system.
Let's talk a little bit more about when you were kids, too, and you mentioned some of the recreation that you did, and you mentioned something about the irrigation ditches and, you know, just the life of the kid growing up on the plantation. You want to talk about the ditches?
The ditches were our swimming pool. I mean, it was right in our front yard, and whether it rained or stormed, I mean, my mama knew which kid could swim. That was my brother and I. My other sisters could not. But it was so awesome because we could catch fish, and whatever was in there, we could eat. It was a fresh seaweed that we ate. We had different types of fishes that we harvested and ate them too. So it was life-giving. And in fact, when my mama planted some plants around the tree, and when they came back in 1973, we took them back to that camp. The camp is still in existence, but no houses. But her trees have flourished. The day we arrived there, all the tamarind trees were in full bloom, and you know they were all harvesting season type. Mangoes were, and we realized that she had planted those trees near the ditch, so it got fed by water, and it has sustained itself all these years. And she stood at that ditch and cried, and in her Filipino dialect, she said, "I'd never remember ever leaving this place because we were born in the houses. We had midwifery birth us, and because we were a plantation camp of only 11 houses. We had games that we played with the single man, and I mean, we had all kind of things to do, and it was never dull. We were family. We were a camp of just being family. We're multi-ethnic in that particular camp. So we ate different foods. We got to know their customs and traditions, and we had total enjoyment because we learned about each other.
Talking about growing up, we all had slingshots. And the best ammunition was ripe tomatoes, because you can hit someone, you don't draw blood, but it hurts like hell. We had rubber guns. We learned windage. We had fight swords. And we had harakiri. If you lost a battle because the Filipinos with banners, we would fight against the Japanese. And when we grew up, this was the time of the rape of Nanking, the rape of Manchuria, the invasion of Burma. So the boys that we played with had comics and magazines of war, of the Navy, of the Japanese Navy, of the Japanese Imperial Army. We were always in battle. We had frying pans. We learned to live off the land, shoot chickens and sukiyaki. These skills destined us to be warriors. So when December 7th came and we went to battle, you know the history of the 442nd. You know the history of the Filipino boys in the 1st Filipino Infantry who went by submarines behind enemy lines to scout for MacArthur. You know, in all the services, the Hawaii people, the Hawaii kids, they excelled as soldiers because we knew jiu-jitsu, we knew kendo, and whenever we have fight against another, the Haoles, we would all for one and one for all. We would fight, we would just band together. We had a tremendous esprit de corps. And this esprit de corps was built by teasing. We tease everybody by the stink of their food. The Filipinos, bagoong. The Chinese, hamha. The Japanese was takuang, or you bow-legged, you know, bow-legged turnip leg, you know. And then the Koreans, the kimchi. And we have a song that we sing, but we tease. You come my house, you eat daikon. That's the Japanese style. You come my house, you eat hamha. That's the Chinese style. You come my house, you eat sandwich. That's the Haoles style. Going on. So we tease one another all the time. So we have a sense of humor. Unique to only Hawaii guys can understand that. Mm-hmm. So that's the spirit of core we had. Mm-hmm. See? And the statistics will show you that this state has about the greatest veterans population. This state has it, you see. So we know, and this was all part of growing up for us. Mm-hmm. And those are the playthings out there.
The what?
Slingshots and all, it's there.
Yeah,
fight shot, all of that, it's all there. See, I'm preparing to talk to a group in 2 days, and you're doing all my speech.
Oh.
It's right here, growing up and what values we learned from living together.
You know, Frank de Lima used to sell a lot of the Portuguese jokes and things like that. And, you know, when we were growing up, nobody felt offensive, you know. It was all in fun and, you know, tease each other. But recently, you know, people are very, very sensitive. And so, you're very careful of what you say. But when we were growing up, you know, it was not. Everybody just, you know, accepted those things.
Was it a way for people to sort of acknowledge that, you know, the differences and just kind of acknowledge that everybody was different from each other?
Yes. Nicknames.
Oh, yeah, nicknames.
Tarzan. Skinny. Or Obaki means the devil. Fatso. Screwball. Diamond Head. These were all nicknames. Sometimes when we talk about, hey, you know, lefty, we don't know who, you know, the guy lefty, you know, the guy lefty. We don't know their name, but we know their nickname.
Like,
you see, always use all nicknames.
Like, you know, among the Okinawan people, Higa is a very common last name, and so this for Mrs.
Let her sit down. It's okay, just sit down.
So this very good friend of ours, Mrs. Higa, told me there were so many Higas on plant. There was this was Black Higa or something. So they would know which particular man they were talking about, you know, by giving them a nickname before their last name, because there were so many with the similar family names, you know.
So how did the nickname start?
I don't know. Somebody maybe just started
some,
it.
Some by physical fitness, of their physical features, and someone would start it and then pick it up from there. When I was went to college, I was known as Black. Hey, Blackie, and I never felt bad. I was darker than the other guys. So somebody started, and it hooked. So in college, I was known as Blackie, see?
So it wasn't a plantation thing? Because didn't it start in the plantation?
Oh, it started plantation. It started, but yes. The idea of naming guys and calling them by lefty or righty or you fat guy and all that, or, you know, all came from growing up, see? And if I call you that, you don't get mad. You have a Howley call you that, they're going to fight. You see, it depends on who you're talking to.
So you're talking about endearment then.
It's endearing, but depends who's giving it. It's who's telling it.
So see. What are your nicknames? You said yours was?
Mine was Black, Blackie.
I didn't have any.
Oh.
I was Putot.
You short.
So,
well, can you say what it means?
Putot? Well, that means short. In fact, when my husband-to-be introduced me to his mama on the island of Kauai, and the first thing she said was, how come you choose somebody Putot? And it hurt me. I was coming from a future mother-in-law. And the beautiful thing was my husband put his arm around me and he said to his mama, but I loved her, mama. You know, I love her. And that was so neat. And I turned out to be her best daughter-in-law because I can cook.
I didn't have a nickname.
Oh, okay.
Didn't have.
Did you have relatives that have nicknames? Or?
No, you know, we have no relatives here at all. Very unusual because only my mom and my dad came here. So all of our relatives are in Japan. But the closest family that we have are the Higas, you know, because they when they first got married, they were neighbors. And so all of their children, they're now, they have great-grandchildren. Only Mr. Higa survives now. Mrs. Higa passed away some time ago. But we're still auntie and to all their children and grandchildren. It's kind of unusual.
Another nickname is Pluto. At the time when Walt Disney, you know. So there's Pluto, there's Minnie. We use that also.
Why?
Because they had long ears. Or they had long nose.
The dogs,
you see? You know? And even now, I have a fetish of ears. I like to touch ears. You're right. It's endearing terms.
The unique thing about nicknames that came about is because, as children, some of the children could not pronounce certain things. I have a cousin that we called him Chokoya, and we wondered why. You know, people wonder why you call him Chokoya. Because he wanted chocolate, but he couldn't say chocolate. Chokoya. Now, when my husband, I asked him, how did he get his name Clark? His real name is Marcelino. And I said, how did you get that name Clark? And he just told me, you know, he's like, oh, when we were young, we used to go watch Clark Gable movie. But all those years, something set wrong with me. Something said he wasn't telling me the truth. So when I finally got to meet his mama, I said, mama, how did he get his name? Oh, yeah, you know, she with her broken English. You go, he like cracker. He couldn't say he wanted cracker. I like clacker, clack, clack. So that's how come his name is Clark. When he found out I knew, he was so embarrassed. He said, how did you find out? I said, from your mama. But these are the names that you pick up as far as children. When they say certain things, it sticks. And that's how we remember people by their nicknames.
Do kids still do that here? Do you know?
Well, it's the opposite. I meet my friends as Richard. You're not Richard. Your name Yasuichi. Yeah. They forget their names. Hell no, you're not Richard. You're Yasuichi. And they get embarrassed, see? Here. I went to the Philippines, San Francisco. So this pretty, pretty Filipino girl. And I said, where are you from? Oh, she's from island. Oh, what part? Waipaho. Give me your name again. My name is Baring. Where do you come from? Waipaho. What's your name? Baring. Oh, you mean your name is Baring? And she got so embarrassed. The pronunciation of Baring is for Baring, that's the English, is Baring. See? So they tried to hide their identity. And especially we know them with their own nickname. We come back with their nickname. And say, the hell with you. Who the hell are you? You know? And this is us.
You think people are too sensitive now, too?
Very much so, but unless you're old, like I am in 79, no, you don't get embarrassed. You know, you just straight out, you know.
In school, when we had our teachers that came from the mainland, and they do the roll call, they see the word, what they see. Like one of my classmates, her last name was R-O-O-T, root. And she didn't answer, because in Filipino, it's root, and root means grass. You know. And then there was another one, B-A-C-O-N, Loretta was her first name. And when the teacher said Loretta Bacon, she wouldn't answer, because the way it's pronounced is supposed to be bacon. So these are the things that we used to laugh and make fun of. Wow. And now some people get offended because it's now. But before time, well, we just enjoyed it totally. In fact, today we still see each other and say, hey, Loretta Bacon. She goes, hey.
So were most of the teachers Holloway then?
Yeah.
You know what happens? That because the teachers couldn't say some of the long Japanese first names and things like that, they gave them English names. So many of them, were the English names that they went by were given by the teachers. And, well, you know, because we're Christian, we all have Christian names, and like my brother is Paul, you know, and the teachers call him Nobuo Yasuda, and he didn't answer. She called several times, and oh, that's me. He didn't recognize, you know, never being called by his Japanese name. It's always Paul everywhere he goes, you know. So funny things happen sometimes with names.
Didn't they have changes of names during World War II, the Japanese?
Yeah.
We had quite a few classmates that changed their Japanese name to, like, Kyoko, changed her name to Stella. We had several that did that. And even to this day, when you call the person by Kyoko, you're classmates. But when you call them Stella, it was later, it seemed, they had picked it up. Mm-hmm. Like, mine is Esperanza. So anybody that calls me Esperanza, that's my classmate. But when they call me Espy, that's because I went out of school already.
Yeah, and here's a story that I've always had this sense of humor since growing up. And my first principalship, I had to teach grades 5, 6, 7, 8. And I had to teach reading. And these Hawaiian kids in Anahola, fishing village, had very difficulty reading, see. So they would say they were eating fish, and they had eggs, and they had bacon. And me, I'm getting so bored. I said, no, that's not bacon, that's bacon. So he would read it, eggs and bacon. I said, that's right, bacon. So pretty soon they were whispering. I said, what are you guys whispering? He said, oh, I'm telling him a joke. All right, tell us the joke. And so he said, this Filipino man went to the store and he's buying bag potapeet. Bag potapeet, what is that? Socks, bags for the feet, that's socks. I said, oh, I'm going to tell you another one. This man went to the store and he want cow in the tin. What is that cow in the tin? That's corned beef. And so we go on and on. But it's just part of my makeup that I go back to my old days. And because I get bored, I teach them my pigeons. But that's part of growing up.
Can you guys have a conversation in pigeon? I was just wondering, like, I don't know, talk about...
Can you pick it up? I mean, if we're talking...
Yeah. Just put it in the middle.
What do you like? What do you want to talk about? What do you like to talk about?
We could talk about any kind.
Well, okay.
We could talk about maybe the kind, what we mean cow this morning.
Mm-hmm. Okay, this morning I had egg and bacon.
Yeah. I had pineapple juice. On top of the ice and put them into the cup. And then I went stir them with a stirrer, you know, the one that get the kind of like look like kind of whipping kind. Yeah, I went whip them.
You whip them good.
I whip them good. I think I'm came real foamy.
You save something for your mama.
Yeah, I give them. Mm-hmm. You Hawaiian, you can give them too. Yeah. That's how we talk all the time. It's so much fun because, and then we can switch over to good English. That's the key, because some people when they were young they could not switch over, and when they went into the military, they had to have somebody be an interpreter.
Yeah. You had that problem, right?
I had that problem, yeah. A lot of my friends, you know, they speak pidgin English. So when they went in the military, they spoke to each other in pidgin English. And Holly guys used to say, what are they talking about? and they couldn't understand, you know, what they were talking about. So I had to, in a way, interpret what they were talking about. In a way, it's good because when you want to talk about another person, you can talk in Pidgin English, and they wouldn't understand what you're talking about.
And that was one of the key things with the 442nd. They had codes in Pidgin so that the Germans could not pick it up at all. That was...
It was like the wind talkers of the Indians. Amongst the Hawaiians, they could speak in Pidgin and nobody else could understand.
So they would broadcast in Pidgin or something to each
other? On radio, mm-hmm. with the squads and the leader, you see. But you had to have two Pidgin speakers on the other end, see, so they understood.
I sense a lot of pride, like with your nicknames, with the Pidgin, just a sense of, I mean, that to me speaks volumes.
Right, yeah,
it makes
us
a very unique.
Can you start again?
Yeah, it really makes us very unique because we have this thing that we can interject with each other. We interplay daily in our lives. As soon as we meet each other, you can tell the people that come from Hawaii that know how to speak Pidgin and then switch over to good English. Then you know that person has really arrived.
Here's an example of, I took some Filipino boys, these are young guys now, to the Filipino camp, and I told them the story that the single Filipino men, they used to combine, compound, put $25, $25, they would buy a car. And all the owners would sit in the front and be looking over, and all the other guys with the chickens in the back, see? But they took good care of the car, spit polish all the time, nice. So I told these, my visitors, you know, these young Filipino boys, the camp laborers, they had such pride in what little they had such great pride in it. So this young Filipino boy said, you know, that's right, Filipinos, they got pride, man. They got fried fish. They got fried rice. You know, that's the story. Yeah. That's the sense of humor. That's Hawaii sense of humor. Okay.
Yeah. What is island humor?
What is Hawaii humor?
Okay. I think I was when I go to Kauai. When I'm sent to Kauai and do the food demo every July, and this year was my 11th year. One year when I was doing all the different ethnic foods, I was explaining. And it's a courtyard on the town of Koloa. And I was talking about the Hawaiians, according to how they came, the different foods. And all of a sudden, this black dog came in the courtyard. And I said, wait, everybody. I said, how many of you are Japanese? They raised their hands. I said, oh, yeah, you Japanese have this special dish called sai min. And I said, how many of you are Chinese? This couple that came from Miami that I had just met, they raised their hand because they were Chinese. I said, you Chinese have this special dish called gon lo min. But how many of you are Filipinos? They raised their hand. I said, you know us Filipinos, that includes me. You saw that black dog came in the courtyard? Us Filipinos, we eat black dog. And we call that dobor min.
So do you have to go or? Oh, really? Okay. Pretty soon?
Well, I have a 6 o'clock deadline.
What are you doing?
Cookies.
6 o'clock deadline?
We can go yet.
Oh, okay, all right. I'm just enjoying this talk so much. I just want to talk to you all day. I don't know.
Can you get copies of this?
Oh, yeah, you will.
What we're saying is rich stuff.
I have to have you sign something, too.
It's rich stuff, you know, and...
Richard,
we're coming in 2006. We're celebrating the 26th the 100th anniversary of the coming of the Filipinos, and all these kinds of interviews of life in the plantation from the Filipino from everyone's perspective are important to us. We want to capture this, and we want to have panels. We want to show
when
some
is
of this
happening?
Stuff. In 2006.
Well, that's when we're doing our show. So when in 2006.
Well, in July of 2006, we're having a national convention on the Philo-American National Historical Society, and we're inviting them to Kauai, to Hawaii. Uh-huh. And if your panel is ready to report,
we'll
put you on the panel.
Well, you can have the program.
Yes, right.
And you can play it
for
them or something. Yeah,
it'd be great.
The whole one-hour program.
Yeah.
So, when you talk about growing up with multi-ethnic communities, did you guys all celebrate each other's festivals?
Oh
stuff
yes,
too?
Mm-hmm, they did. Like And then you're invited to wedding receptions.
Sensitive, yeah?
Okay. Yeah, it picks up everything. Mm. Okay, all right.
Well, you know, you're like your neighbors, if they're having a Filipino birthday or something, celebration, it may be just within the family, but they bring you the food that they prepared, you know, adobo and whatever things they did. And
she's coming in.
And, you know, the Japanese families, they made sushi and things that you'd always share with your neighbors, you know. So that's why people here eat all of the different ethnic foods. You know, they're familiar with them. You grew up with them.
So did you celebrate all the New Year's together and all the holidays?
Generally, yeah, they were invited. And, you know, to the Hawaiian, you would eat the Hawaiian food. And, you know, everybody grew up enjoying poi. And
so what about, like, Bon Festival? And
yes, there's always food, you know, for the Bon festivals and things like that. And people, you all come in.
Oh, sorry? But
in the Bon dancing, we all jump in and we just follow. It's easy to follow, see. Mm-hmm.
Can you describe how that is? I mean, what a bon is? And
well,
how you
a bon dance, you better describe a bon dance.
No. The obong is a season where they honor the people who have passed on. And, you know, there's a special ceremony at the church first. And then they have the bon dance. And usually they have a lot of food booths and, you know, live music to dance to. And some of the dances have changed. They tried to put electric slide and things like that recently, you know, but to keep the young people interested. But they still do the old traditional dances, especially the folk dance type of thing, like the Fukushima group and the Okinawan dance group and things like that. So we begin the bon season right here in the plantation village on the first Saturday of June. And then after that in Hawaii, every Saturday, there's a bon dance someplace. In Japan, it's only a two-week period in August that they have obon season. But in Hawaii, it's celebrated all year long. And one of the last bon dances at the Okinawa Festival on Labor Day weekend at the Waikapiolani Park, you know, on a Saturday night.
Fortunately, when they do bon dance, it's routine dancing. Mm-hmm. So anybody that has some rhythm can jump in, except you got to wear a kimono. So we in there and we join, you know, and we make our own steps, you know. So but it's participatory. And when you participate in a group, somehow you get socially intoxicated. There's a term called social intoxication. And this is what happens when you put groups together and let them move together. Mm-hmm. They become intoxicated, see? Hypnotize if you want, but it's part of a natural phenomenon.
Well, you know, temples like the Honganji, they have it for two nights. They have practice sessions during the week. Once or twice a week, a teacher will be there to teach them how to do the steps. So, you know, you can, when the night comes, you can follow them better. That's what they do.
Uh-huh. Is there a Filipino festival too?
Oh yes,
here? Rizal. Is that how do you pronounce
well,
it?
Well, yeah, Jose Rizal was one of the martyrs of the Philippines. In fact, we have this Filipino community center with his statue that was just opened recently. But we have Christmas with all those paroles that you see that I had mentioned in the Filipino single men's house. And again, every festival, no matter which ethnicity, food is always the central focal point. People will come to eat the foods because
and bring their own food to the table.
And say that again.
Yeah, see, for example, in our home in the Filipino, the theme of that is a baptismal party. And Filipinos, if you have party, you're going to have food. You're going to have music. So the food is laid out. You got roast pig. The Japanese will come and they'll bring their sukiyaki. And the Chinese will come and they put their noodles. So it's all together. See, they come and join us and we eat together. That's another way that amalgamated us into something very unique. In Hawaii, you got to eat. You got to love to eat, you know. That's one of our traits.
How much did the homeland affect, you know, when you, I don't know, your families, like, especially during the wars and
things? The most groups were very frugal, especially the Filipinos. They got by with practically nothing. Why? Because they were saving money to send home. That was the only money they had in the Philippines. All that money went home. So the Filipinos, the single men, were very, very frugal. They work hard 5 days a week, but Saturday comes, they put on their best silk shirt, put their pomade, ilang-ilang, and they will go to the Dima Dance, you know. And the Dima Dance girls were blondes and brunettes, etc. And, you know, I paid 10 cents to dance with them. So not until the war came, and some of the boys that were in the war went to the Philippines and got married, the single guys, see. And then they started families. Otherwise, many of the Filipinos who joined the army from the mainland, they were destined to be bachelors until the war came. The war, by the way, December 7th, was the great emancipator. It took us from Hawaii to the mainland, and for the first time we saw white guys do menial tasks. You see, it changed the whole complex. When the war was over, we knew how good we were, that we were just as good as anybody at soldiering. But when we came back, we went to college on the GI Bill, we came home and we were never satisfied. We got into politics, and that's why the beginning of the emancipation from the plantation system.
Can you talk, is the Dima Dance the same as the taxi dance hall?
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
What is that like? What was that like?
Well, you go to Saturdays, they go downtown, Alapak Street, and they have nice music, and saxophone and all that. Not Hawaiian music. It's American dance music. Foxtrot, waltz. Pretty girls are there and dress real sleek, you know. And you have favorite dancers, see? And so they meet every Saturday you go, and, oh, Manong, you know. As long as you don't know the name, you call him Manong, see? And then you remember me, you see, and I'll buy a ticket. And then she will take the ticket and put it in her brassiere, and you can't take it out. So, and it was colorful.
It was only the boys who went, though.
Men, yeah.
Yes, yes.
There's one right in Waipahu, you know, on Waipahu Street. I remember going by, driving by, you know, right on Waipahu Street. And you'd see some of the girls sometimes, you know, sitting outside. Yes. And then in the Filipino dormitory, there's a picture, though. We have a picture of some of the girls, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's pictures of the Dima Dance girls.
We have a picture on the wall there. Yeah.
How did the women feel about that? I don't know. Did you know anybody who went?
No, I came from a family that never danced. So.
Okay. Well. Let me tell you this story. I tell a story of the Japanese. They have picture brides. Mm-hmm. And the picture brides was introduced because the managers felt if your family was stabilized, you were a better laborer. So they brought picture brides. The Chinese had picture brides. Korean had picture brides. Filipinos had no picture brides. They stole brides because of the ratio. And one docent friend of mine, he said, my aunt was
cowboy.
She was cowboyed, means kidnapped, 5 times, which tells me she enjoyed it, see? And it was part of life. The Filipino boys would cowboy. My own father cowboyed. Until I went to college, I never knew I had a half-brother. My mother had already married. And her first husband was in the sea. My father comes and cowboys her. Now, why cowboy? The Filipinos like to go to the movie. They go to watch cowboy shows. And they say the lasso, you know, kidnapping the women. That's what they did, see. It's a true phenomenon. And the concept of this is called cowboy.
Cowboy. I never heard that term, I guess. Cowboy, and among cowboy. The Filipino people, probably.
You mentioned, that the war was opened up a lot of eyes regarding the social hierarchy here, and as far as the first time that people saw white people doing menial jobs. Mm-hmm. So can you talk about the social hierarchy of the plantation? What was that?
Okay. Back in plantation, if you're white, you're boss, you're the boss type. Mm-hmm. You're the boss or you're Luna. So you wore breeches and leggings, and you don't do menial tasks. But all us other guys, we do pick up rubbish, do anything, pick up slop, you know. That was evident. But when we went to the mainland and saw white guys do this, we couldn't get over it. It was a shock to us.
On this plantation, you know, for instance, they had, I guess, leased beach land out in Nanakuliwe where the Hawaiian Electric Power Plant is. And there was one for the supervisors and one for the other employees, you know, and they had separate, you know, facilities for them. So in a way, you know, it was kind of segregation, you know. And then they had a what they call the Haole Clubhouse with a tennis court. You know, the Japanese had their own clubhouse and a tennis court also there. The other ethnic groups, I'm not sure about the Filipino group, but, you know, that's the way it was.
But the Philippines were too busy fighting chicken. Chicken fights.
Cup fights.
It's illegal, but we knew where they're going to fight.
Uh-huh. Because there's a lot of gambling, too.
Of course. Yeah. People in Hawaii love to gamble. They gamble in agates, the gandle fight sword, the gangle in fishing, or rather chicken fights. We gamble with marbles, with milk tops by hitting that. Everything is gamble. That's why Hawaii likes to go to Las Vegas. We're all a bunch of gamblers, but we don't want the gamblers to come here. That's a strange phenomenon.
You have that sign there. Would you read that?
Yeah. As I'm going to talk to some high school kids, I want to show them what their grandpa and grandmother had to work, their work day. And this is the typical work day. At 4 a.m., the women wake up to prepare breakfast and lunch. The siren goes. At 5 o'clock is a wake-up whistle. At 5:45, they gather at the train or walk to the field. At 6 o'clock, the day begins. At 8 o'clock, small cow-cow time, 10-minute break, you eat. 11:30, cow-cow time, that's half an hour. 12 o'clock, cow-cow pow, go work again. 4:30, pauhana whistle. This was the 8-hour. And eventually went to 10 hours. 8 o'clock, lights out in the whole camp. And they did this for 100 years.
I just don't know how you could work, how you could do any recreation.
That's right.
No.
So the Hawaiians, who love the sun, the sea, the surf, they began working 6 hours, 6 days a week, and only Sunday to go and take care of taro and to go fishing. They didn't like the industrialization. So that's why the Hawaiians did not stay with the plantation. So the story we tell here is the search for cheap labor. Mm-hmm. You lose the Hawaiians, you get the Chinese go and open restaurants, so you go to, you couldn't go because of laws, you couldn't go to Asia because of the yellow peril, the immigration law, so they went to Europe where they had devastation and they wanted to improve their life, the Portuguese. Then you go to Puerto Rican, see? It's this. Our story is all search for cheap labor.
The other reason why the Hawaiian population declined was, you know, in 1820, the first white people to live permanently in the islands came, and they were missionaries and graduates of the Ivy League schools who brought Christianity to the islands because of this Hawaiian boy who went back east with the whaling boats and then became a Christian, and he wanted Christianity brought to his people. So that it was in 1820. And they knew about, you know, economics and things like that and found the conditions in Hawaii good for growing cane. So the first plantation was on Kauai, and James Dole started the plantation on Wahiwa. But the white man also brought diseases to which the Hawaiians had never been exposed, you know, like measles and chickenpox and things like that. So many of them died, and sugar was profitable, but no one to work in the fields, and so they had to turn to Asia for labor. And the Chinese came 20 years before the Japanese.
I just, you know, you had said that you never worked in the plantation and you avoided it. So can you talk about, as a Hawaiian, why you would never want to?
I seen how hard plantation workers had worked in the fields all day out in the sun. It's not very easy, not a very easy work. So I told myself, I'm not going to do anything like that. I'm going to try and get education and move away from here and find a better job and raise my family somewhere else, not here, because of that time where there was a lot of labor work. I didn't want any labor work for my family. And that's why I thought that, no, I don't want to do anything like plantation work.
Did any of your family in the past work on plantations that you can remember?
None did.
None of them ever did?
Why? Was that because they had other options?
They decided, well, let's start with the beginning. There were three...
Oh, hold on a sec. I think we need...